From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. A recent national report by the Natural Resources Defense Council put Wisconsin in the top 10 states for most extreme weather events in 2012. Think back to the spring-like weather last March and the drought last year that much of the state is still recovering from. Wisconsin Public Radio's Steve Roysom talked with La Crosse National Weather Service forecaster Jeff Boyne and warning coordination meteorologist Todd Shea about the recent weather patterns. Todd Shea says extreme weather is a buzzword and not an official weather term.
I think as most people would use it, it's talking about weather that has a big impact on a large population area or a large group of people, or it can be a big financial burden to a community or to an area. So, you know, you think about even things like droughts and may not always impact people in cities directly and stuff, but it's a big financial burden to a large group of people. I think when you're talking about extreme, that would be one definition. Maybe another too is anything that falls well away from what is considered normal. So if, you know, a 4 to 8 inch snowfall is kind of at the higher end of most of our snows, if you end up with that 18, 20 inch snow, that would be on the very outskirts of what's normal. So that also would be a definition of extreme, I guess. So.
A report by the National Resource Defense Council says in 2012, Wisconsin experienced a total of 123 broken heat records, 20 broken snow records, 35 broken precipitation records, and also one large wildfire, placing Wisconsin in the top 10 states with the most extreme weather in 2012. Does the National Weather Service agree that the state's weather in 2012 was pretty, there's that word again, extreme? Todd?
It had elements that were extreme. I mean, anytime you deal with the drought, and I think Jeff's going to touch a little bit on the drought, but you know, the drought was a significant event for not only Wisconsin but the region, and then we also had the heat, and as part of that, we ended up with heat fatalities again in the state. You know, we don't often get fatalities from weather, so we had the heat-related issues around the 4th of July when people were doing a lot of recreational activities and festivals. You know, the severe weather with thunderstorms and stuff, and even some of the winter weather last year was pretty quiet. I don't think there was quite as many extremes there. In fact, in Wisconsin in 2012, we only had 4 tornadoes. One of the lowest numbers in, you know, certainly in recent years, but from an average of about 23 a year down to just 4 for last year, it certainly wasn't a tornado year. So I think it was some of those other elements you talked about. The drought and heat were probably the biggest stories of the year. You know, we have these fluctuations from year to year. Obviously, we've been in a drier pattern, but, you know, 2011, we ended up with a lot more tornadoes. So I think it just has a way of kind of fluctuating from year to year of how the weather patterns set up and how things materialize.
In recent years, is weather in the region, the state or nation becoming more extreme, or is it just more of kind of an ebb and flow?
Some places it has been more extreme. Again, I think it kind of has a way of working out and averaging out. But, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen a greater number of billion-dollar disasters in the country. And I guess I don't have an exact answer why that is. In 2011, we saw a lot of historic tornado outbreaks that were part of that. The tornado outbreaks were historic in a sense that they hit populated areas, and we had an unusual number of fatalities. But then you more recently think about was a relatively quiet tropical season, we had an event like Hurricane Sandy that hits a very large population area, had a tremendous impact, both in lives and, of course, damage. And then you include the drought in there, and those all add up as billion-dollar disasters. We certainly have had a rough couple years here.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm Steve Roysom. And we're talking about extreme weather, the drought, and other topics with Todd Shea, we've been hearing from, a warning coordinator meteorologist, and Jeff Boyne, forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. How do we know if this had anything to do with global warming? Could there be some other explanation?
When we look at this in more short time frames, like just the last couple of years, it's as far as I see it, it's really hard to tie the big picture of global warming to specific events. I guess it's up to those researchers that study climate change and global warming to determine how much of these events are linked at all. But I tend to believe it's just the way the weather patterns set up over the seasons, over the summer. You know, maybe Jeff can touch on the ocean influences and stuff, but we look at these bigger term setups and then how they, I guess, keep our area in persistent weather patterns. In other words, days after days of tornadoes or unusually dry and warm weather like we saw in 2012.
Jeff? The other thing you got to look at is the length of records. A lot of our records are shorter now than they used to be. When we close a station, a new station opens up, so it may have a shorter record as far as time periods. Yeah. That sometimes enhances our number of records that we tend to get, large ones. When you get short-term stations, it's very easy to set records and stuff like that. So a lot of rainfall records you might get, the station may have only been in existence for the last 10 years or so. As far as other things that could be affecting the weather, besides, there's no doubt that the carbon dioxide levels have been increasing over the last several decades. That's pretty well documented out there. The key question is whether that's the main factor or there's other factors like, for example, water vapor is also a greenhouse gas that can, as you increase the number of cars in an area, you increase your water vapor, which could affect your minimum temperatures, how cold they will tend to be, everything else. That would result in less records as far as being established and the cold side goes. But also, with the increased water vapor and everything else, you may have warmer low temperatures being set. And that's where we've actually been seeing a lot of our records going on. For example, the month of January, if you look back at the last 30 years, the 1971 to 2000 averages compared to the 1981 to 2010 averages, we've actually had an increase in the January minimum temperatures by at least 3 to 4 degrees, which could have an influence as far as the amount of snow that we tend to see too.
I just wanted to go back and touch on the extreme weather. The idea again is,
go ahead, Doug.
You know, if in some cases, as a population, we're just putting ourselves more at risk at times too. There's a whole risk management side of this of, you know, people building in floodplains, people building along coastlines. As a human population, these traits that we are undertaking and building and things like that, where we don't normally see such extreme events except maybe every 30, 40, 50 years. And so in that period of time, you build up a population database in a perhaps vulnerable area. The weather event occurs that maybe naturally occurs every so often. And it just seems like, well, why is all this happening now? And I think to a certain extent there's an aspect of that too, you know, that makes it seem like in our quick way we live these days with so much information that why is this all happening now when maybe it had been happening? We just never really had populations in that spot or had information about it. One more example I can kind of give from that would be maybe the Joplin tornado that hit in May 2011, ironically the same day that tornadoes hit parts of Wisconsin. If that tornado had been a couple miles outside of Joplin, it would have been a still a large tornado, but it probably would have been a pretty quiet event that would have gotten very little coverage. It happened to go through a population area of roughly the size of La Crosse, Wisconsin or so, and you know, lead to, what, 250 fatalities or something like that. So I don't believe it's global warming that now we're getting EF5s going through cities. It just, in this case, happened to hit a population center. So those, some of those aspects, too.
We ended 2012 with much of the state still in a drought. We've had some snow this winter. And Jeff Boyne, if you want to answer this one, have we seen enough snow? And Todd, jump in if you want to. Have we seen enough snow to impact the drought?
Really not. Wintertime precipitation is fairly light. In general, we see usually around 2 to 3 inches of precipitation for the winter. A lot of times we look at a huge amount of snow. For example, last winter, we said, oh, the drought's going to get worse because we didn't have a lot of snow last winter. Well, the precipitation was actually normal. We just ended up with more rain instead of snow. Well, the problem is a lot of snow is what's the water content of that snow when it falls. In grade school, we were always taught 10-to-1 ratios out there. Well, in reality, that's not the case. That's judged by what the air mass, what the temperatures are aloft, what type of crystals fall, and that helps you as far as your ratios go. For example, this week, we back in I think it was Saturday, if I remember right in timing, we had snow ratios of 40 to 50 to 1. That means basically if you had 1 inch of water, you'd end up with 40 to 50 inches of snow out of that. For example, this morning, we've actually saw more of a 10 to 1 ratio. So we're back to what our grade school was, showing a 10 to 1 ratio. 10 inches, 1 inch of water equals 10 inches of snow. So you got to average that over time. Climatologically, it's about 13 to 1 is what this local area is, as far as that's concerned. If you look at all the precipitation we've had this winter, in the last week or so, we've had about an inch of precipitation. Overall, for the long term, we're only maybe a half inch to an inch above normal. So that's not a lot when your precipitation deficit's coming in. We're running around 6 to 7 inches. So that's hard to make that up in a winter time.
Does anyone look at snow as a drought saver?
Usually it's not. It's more of a protection for wintertime crops out there. Those who plant wintertime crops, it helps protect them. It helps protect other plants from getting, if it gets excessively cold, from dying out. So it's more of a coverage than anything else. It does affect the potential springtime flooding, big time there. One of the problems with this time of year is if we do get rain, a lot of times the ground's frozen, and that water may just run right off into the rivers, and we see enhanced rises in the river. We just had that last week with
Prairie du Chien.
Well, Grant County. In there had it. Some of the rivers down in Grant County had some issues with that very thing, because all the water basically is hitting concrete because the ground's frozen and just runs right off into the rivers. Well, that made no difference in our drought situation. We got an inch to 2 inches of water down there, and that water ended up right in the rivers, and it's flowing right away from the area. So it made really no impact to the soil moisture. And that's our biggest issue coming into this spring, is we've taken out a lot of our soil moistures. A lot of the water levels are extremely low right now, and lake levels are extremely low. The snowmelt can affect lake levels. It can increase it, but a lot of it depends what your water content is, and with the water content in the snow right now, it's not great enough to really make a huge dent in those either.
How much precipitation are we going to need to get out of the drought? Let's say that spring hits, the water melts. How many inches do we need to soak our ground?
Depends on what type of soil types you have, for one thing. If it's more of a clay soil, it'll take a little less, because the soils can take a lot. Sandy soils, for example, the La Crosse area, it may take a good 4 to 6 inches above normal in the spring months to actually get us out of the drought completely. You got to build up those groundwater levels that were so down low. So fortunately, the snowpack that you do get right now does help with the moisture that the topsoils will have. So when it gets warm enough, the farmers can plant. At least they'll have some topsoil moisture to deal with.
And I heard about a national forecast about a month ago saying that we are going to likely be in a second year of drought. My question to you is, how much credence should I pay to a national forecast?
That's tough, because the problem is the climate models that we look at, trying to make those judgments. A lot of us just looking back at past things of what's happened in the past. Well, those are not always the most reliable when it comes down to doing that. We've had multi-year droughts before. 87 through 89 was a multi-year drought. 75 to 78 was one. Had a couple droughts in the 30s.
Is it possible to be in and out of a drought in a single year, or do they tend to be several-year events?
Not always. We do have very short-term events. 2004 and 5 were very short events. So a lot of times they can be short, a few months even, with that. Sometimes you can have rapid development droughts, what we call flash droughts. Like in 2003, there was a rapidly developed, we went from a very wet season, wet part of the thing. By the time we got to August, we turned hot and excessively dry real quick. So we end up with a moderate drought rapidly developing across here. Matter of fact, we even got to severe drought in just a couple of months. And then a couple of months later, it was gone. We end up with above normal precipitation. So a lot of it depends on how warm you get and how much moisture you had, and also where you are in the growing season, really. When you start getting into the months of July, where corn needs a lot of the moisture, it tends to bring a lot of moisture out. At that time, it's bringing out almost an inch and a half of water out of the soils at that time period. If you get a dry period in that time period, you could easily go into drought rather quickly. In August, it's the soybeans that tend to tap a lot of moisture.
Is this the largest drought we have ever seen?
No, we've seen larger ones. The 30s droughts were fairly large areas. 1910-11 was a large drought. Another drought that occurred back in the 75-76 drought was a fairly expansive drought. So we have seen them. 87 to 89 was a fairly large drought. So we have seen them in the past, larger than this one.
Any anticipated weather patterns in 2013 that could replenish our groundwater? Or is it just too soon to tell?
Well, it's too hard to say. We're heading into a time period which the climate models usually do not do well. We call it a spring barrier with it. As the sun starts to move into the northern hemisphere, that affects what the water temperatures are across the central and eastern Pacific. What's funny is you get those water temperatures, they actually can influence what we see here in the upper Midwest. Those La Niñas or El Niños, what we call them there. But there's also things up in the North Pacific called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation right now, where we've got a warmer water sitting over the central North Pacific right now. And that's actually more on the decadal side. That actually may last 1 to 2 decades out there. So there's a lot of influence out there as far as what can affect us with that one. Right now, the climate models are suggesting maybe a weak La Niña or basically colder than normal temperatures. Maybe not La Niña-like, but still it's going to be like that with colder water temperatures over the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. If that continues into the summer, that influence tends to be hotter and drier for us. But the key question is, what does it do in the spring? And some models are suggesting we may see a wetter than normal March and a wetter than normal April. So we'll see. But the models don't do the greatest. That's the reason why I call it a spring barrier at times at trying to forecast that. So
weather is our topic today on Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Steve Rysom. Joining us, Todd Shea, warning coordination meteorologist, and Jeff Boyne, forecaster with the National Weather Service. With the snow up north, the snow we've seen, any ideas to what we could be seeing downriver? Well, you've touched on it a bit.
A lot of it depends on how much snow we get over the next couple of weeks and how much moisture we tend to get. There's times that we felt that there was going to be a lot of flooding going on. That was about 2 years ago. We had a huge snowpack, expected a lot of flooding out of it, and it melted so fast that actually, it melted slower. I take it back. It was melting slower, and the water release came out slow, so we didn't get as much of an impact down here. So a lot of it depends on what your snowpack is, what your temperatures are during the time period. But the longer you keep that snowpack before it melts, the more potential you have.
There's really certainly not a whole lot of liquid equivalent in our snowpack at the moment. Jeff talked earlier about we've had a lot of light, fluffier snows as of recently. So I don't foresee anything based on snow cover right now that would lead to a significant flooding issue. But as we hit on, there are a lot of variables that come into the spring snowmelt, including the liquid content, but also how fast it melts, as Jeff talked about, whether we have a spring rain, the timing of it, if it's early or late in the season. So there's several more variables that come into play. So like Jeff said, a couple years ago, we thought we were perfectly set up for a significant issue, and we hardly had anything because it was an ideal melting scenario. So, but based on snow cover that's out there right now, we don't foresee certainly any moderate or major issues at this point.
Another factor going into this is the drought. The water levels, stream levels are down right now. So they can take the water into them quite a bit, more than what we normally would heading in, because typically they're a lot higher coming into the winter. And that actually ends up causing another factor with the rivers being so low. It can result in ice jams out there that could potentially cause some localized flooding in some areas.
Let's talk about last March. We saw May-like weather. What caused it? How did we get such an early spring?
Well, part of the reason why we ended up seeing it was we had anomalous southerly flow come up from the Gulf of Mexico. Brought warmer air up into the region. It was very persistent through the month, just continuously, which is unusual. Usually you see short periods of that time period, but it kept bringing the systems northward into the area. We also ended up with a large high-pressure system that centered over the eastern parts of the continent, continent, basically North United States and also even Canada, stayed warmer than normal. A lot of that had to do with warmer than normal waters that were located across the western Pacific at that time period. And that affects the jet stream where it's located. And that convection was so persistent, or those thunderstorms were so persistent out there, it basically locked the jet stream in place. So we ended up with a ridge of high pressure over top of us, kept our southerly flow coming up, and persistently brought than normal temperatures. The other thing is we had a little snow coming into that time period, so there was very little snow. The ground was able to warm up quicker than normal. And also we didn't have to melt the snow, too. So a lot of times when you get the warmer air, the initial stuff has to melt that snow off before the ground can warm up well. There was none. So the ground warmed up rather quickly, which allowed the plants to get ahead of schedule as far as growing, too. We had things that flower normally in May flowering in March. If you look back at the records back even in the 1878 one, there was similar occurrences occurring during that time period, too.
Have we seen any sort of residual effects from our bonus spring, our extra long spring-like weather?
Well, one of the things that actually did was ended up causing some problems with our fruit trees out there. Some of the fruit trees started to get ready to blossom early. They lost their initial blossoms as soon as we had the April temperatures, which we normally see. We saw some freezes in there. Matter of fact, what was it, 11 frost freeze advisories we ended up going with?
Todd.
You know, it's not unusual to get frost and freeze usually in April, but because March had been so warm, it was kind of a bigger deal and a bit unusual last April, certainly.
Have you known how long it's been since we've seen one of these before? Or? No. It seems so unique, so eccentric.
It was unique. 1910 was one year. 1878 was another year where we saw that, where we went excessively warm and then cooled right back down the next month in April. So,
and wasn't March actually warmer than April?
It was. It was just a couple of tenths of a degree warmer than
pretty rare.
April, which is extreme. Matter of fact, that's the first time it's ever happened.
Jeff Boyne is a forecaster, and Todd Shea is a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. They talked with Wisconsin Public Radio's Steve Roysom about some of the unusual weather the state has been experiencing. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, photos, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.